The Yvonne Dunnett Show, every Monday at 11 a.m. The Yvonne Dunnett Show is a program dedicated to raising the public awareness that will empower the listeners with information, thoughts, and experiences to help them be informed and better advocates for their overall health and well-being. For more information and to sign up for Yvonne's newsletter, visit www.ycdholistichealing.com. And now your host, Yvonne Dunnett.
Good morning. It's so great to be with you this morning. Namaste to you all. I honor the place in you, which is of light, of peace, and of love. And when you are in that place in you, and I am in that place in me, we are one. And I'm so delighted today that I have with me author Quincy Whitney. Quincy Whitney is the primary arts writer for the Boston Sunday Globe, New Hampshire Weekly, and she did that for 14 years and was a Eugene O'Neill Critic Fellow, Salzburg Seminar Fellow, Metropolitan Museum of Art Research Fellow, and Hooking Houses Trust's UK Fellow covering the 2013 Emotionland Museum Stradivarius Exhibition. A graduate of Wake Forest University, she is also the author of Hidden History of New Hampshire and lives in New Hampshire. And her book that she has so well written, American Luthier, it is a book about Carlene Hutchins, and it talks about the art and science of the violin. But having read the book, I can honestly say that author Quincy Whitney has done a magnificent job of literally combining and showing the bridge between the artist, the scientist, and the musician, and how that combination ends up connecting us, not only with our mind, our body, and our spirit, but offers a contribution to the world that Carlene Hutchins has made, that has made a huge difference. Welcome, Quincy.
Thank you, Yvonne.
It's so nice to have you here. How did you meet Carlene Hutchins?
I was an arts reporter for the New Hampshire Weekly of the Sunday Globe in August of 97, which was many years ago. And I was at a New Hampshire Humanities Council meeting. And ironically, I was listening to the keynote speaker, who was Doris Kearns Goodwin, and didn't have any inkling I would actually become a biographer. But this person next to me said, if you cover the arts in New Hampshire, you need to go meet this violin maker who lives in a cabin in the summers up on Lake Winnipesaukee. So I picked up the phone and called Carlene Hutchins and said, this is Quincy Whitney with the Boston Globe, and I'd like to do a story on you. And she said, no, I don't have time. And she was 87 years old, and I thought, this lady is pretty cool because she doesn't need me, and she doesn't really care about celebrity. And so I didn't know what to do because no one had ever said that to me. So I hung on the phone, and the next thing she said was, what's your angle? And I had never had anyone ask me that either. So the first thing that came out was the truth, which was I said I was interested in stories where science and art overlap. It was like the door suddenly opened, and she said, well, that's exactly what I do. When do we talk? So we talked. I did this story, and 2 weeks after it ran in the Boston Globe in August of 97, she called me up, and she said, you're the first writer who's made my work sound interesting. Would you consider writing my biography? At that time, I was tired of weekly deadlines, and I thought of a big project might be interesting, but she could not hire me, and I could not quit my job. So before I get on to the fact that I sort of decided I was going to be drawn into this project, a month later, my husband and I were traveling in, we're planning an anniversary trip to Italy, and we were going to Milan and Venice. And I mentioned this to Carlene, whom I just met, and she said, well, if you're going to northern Italy, would you consider going to Cremona, the city of violins, where Stradivari was born? Because there's a luthier friend of mine who's moved to studio, and I can't find him. So we thought, well, this is an adventure. So we decided to go to Cremona, took a detour. We found ourselves in a rental car in this piazza in Cremona and walking up the stairs to this workshop, thinking that there was no sign on the door. There was no way of knowing where he went. So we had sort of hit a dead end. We came down the stairs. We're getting in the rental car when we saw these two students come across the piazza, and one of them seemed to have what looked like a violin case. So in my broken Italian, this person goes up to a phone booth, when actually there were phone booths, which is rather an anomaly right now. And I said Biso, because the person we were looking for was the maestro Francesco Bisolati. He was a very well-known, one of the best well-known luthiers in Cremona. And I said Biso, and this young student said, Biso, Maestro Bisolati, we are going to visit him. We have not met him, but we're going to buy a viola. So the four of us start wandering down these cobblestone streets, not knowing where we're going. And then suddenly two Japanese gentlemen come out of nowhere and say, Biso, Biso. And so we say yes. And they lead us into this little courtyard with this old door and a chipped green paint on the old door. And we open it up, and there is the maestro. And he doesn't speak a word of English. But I hand him a letter from Carlene Hutchins, and he beams, very happy to have the books that she has sent him, which she edited. And he turns to his apprentice, Lorenzo Cassi, who speaks English. And he said, would you please take the Americans down to the center of Cremona, to the big Palazzo Comunale, which is this gallery where ten of the most famous violins are sitting in glass cases, the Amati, the Guarneri, Stradivari. So we go to this gallery, and on the way to the gallery, there's a long hall. And on that hall, the violin-making school of Cremona has decided to put an exhibit together for the month of October, and it was only for 30 days. If we had come a week before or a week after, we would have missed this exhibit, which I think of often. And the exhibit was From Tree to Violin, where they explain the craft and how wood is cut. And then suddenly the most famous Italian makers, beginning with Amati, who invented the violin, and then Guarneri and Stradivari. And my husband, Eli, is waving to me at the end of the hallway because he has a very long stride, as anyone who knows him knows. And he got ahead of me. And there at the last panel of the exhibit was a tribute to Carlene Mealy Hutchins, an American female luthier. And that's when I realized the cosmos was talking to me, because she wasn't making any of this up. She didn't know the exhibit existed. And here amongst the great Italian masters of violin making, they were paying tribute to an American female. So I thought maybe that her story was for real, and it started to hook me right then.
So that was the moment that you decided that you wanted to be the author of her biography.
I think the whole, the seeds for it were long before, because I was, I happened to be an identical twin, and the two of us started out musically with the violin lessons in the seventh grade. Yeah. And at the end of that year, it was clear from the look on my teacher's face that there was one of us who was a musician and the other one who's not. So I gave up the music at that point, and my sister became a violinist, a cellist, and then a harpist. So I think there was this yen to get back to music somehow, and maybe it was through words. But then at Wake Forest freshman year, I realized that I was passionate about finding connections between subjects that seemed to be opposite, instead of looking for the walls that academia puts up. So I was always interested in how the sacred connects to the secular, and in art and science and music. So here was this lady who was living those connections. And that's what drew me in more than anything else.
And you, of all people, I think your art with words is so magnificent, and you have a way of making those bridges. So in reading your book, I can honestly say that you captured her in a non-judgmental way. You let us know not only about her art, her science, and her love for music, the struggles of her life, but also the history behind the resonance, the music, the acoustics, the sound, all of it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
I appreciate the compliment. So let me ask you, when you were interviewing her and learning all about her, was it a lengthy series of times together? How did it work as you were capturing and learning all about her history?
Yeah, actually, it starts out with the fact that she couldn't hire me. She couldn't pay me, and I couldn't quit my job. So over 5 years' time, I realized, since she was 87 when I met her, that I had to just interview her. So I would visit her in Montclair, New Jersey, in her home where she had her laboratory and all of her workshop. And then in the summers, I would interview her in her cabin in Winnipesaukee. And for 5 years, that's all I did. And I would come up the hill from her cabin and think to myself, how am I ever going to tell this story? Because it seemed every time we talked, it went so many different directions, art, science, and music, and also around the globe. She would get calls from a dendrochronologist in Paris and a luthier in China. And she had built an international organization devoted to violin acoustics. So then one day I was Googling, as we all do when we're curious about something these days, and I found that the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York gave fellowships, research fellowships, to someone studying something in the collection. She had given a set of her octet instruments to the Met in 1989 to celebrate the 100th anniversary of that collection. And there they were, and I thought, maybe that's the connection. So I went to New York, and I talked to the fellowship's director, and she said, well, you're not a typical candidate. You're not an art history PhD or a curator. You're a journalist. And I said, and journalists are used to not fitting in anywhere. And so she said, apply. And I think I got 2 6-month fellowships. I lived in New York from 2004 to 2006 at 2 different 6-month periods. And I woke up every day and lived Cinderella's life and went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and did research about anything under the sun related to the octet. The interesting thing about the octet, which made it so comprehensively difficult, because there were so many different subjects that the octet leads you to. It leads you to, if the octet is...
Explain what an octet is.
The violin octet is 8 instruments across the range of a piano, from an 11-inch treble to a 7-foot contrabass. So you have all of the voices, all of the timbres of the human voice. There's a treble, a soprano, a mezzo, an alto, a tenor, a baritone, a bass, and a contrabass. And they're all violins. And this is what she invented. But when you research the octet, you end up looking at the history of the quartet, the history of violin, viola, cello, and bass that are all separate histories. And then you have women luthiers and how art and science connect and the history of luthiery and the history of the orchestra and the history of families of instruments, consorts, and the history of museums, which has to do with collecting and actually museums start at the same time that science does, because both disciplines are collecting artifacts and observing and studying them.
Now, just for our listening audience, what is a luthier?
A luthier comes from the word lute. So it's a lute maker originally, but now has been expanded to mean anyone making stringed instruments.
Excellent. And so you began by going in and researching at the Metropolitan, and you were able to begin getting the background history related to all of that. And then you met with her on a continual basis, you were saying.
Yes. And with respect to what happened from the Metropolitan Museum of Art research is that I ended up with a prologue that went on forever about every subject under the sun. I had a 200-page prologue. I didn't know how I was going to use all that. And then it hit me that possibly I could separate it all out and see where it related to particular parts of her life. But I discovered that I started to use a musical motif called an intermezzo. So in between the chapters about Carlene, you see a chapter about the history of music and the history of acoustics. And I realized that it's not just setting her life in context that those intermezzos do, but they also poke holes in the assumptions that people made that are erroneous to begin with.
So what were the assumptions that you realized that people made?
The first one was when luthiers were criticizing Carlene for applying science, the science of acoustics, to making instruments is an absurd kind of criticism, because it implies that music is only an art. And music from the beginning of time has always included acoustics as the central mode, which is this combination of what a resonating tone does and how it's interpreted by the human brain,
by the ear
and the human brain. Mm-hmm. It's vibration, it's everything else. So from the beginning, music has been a science.
Mm-hmm.
Other luthiers said, you know, how could you possibly compare a contemporary instrument to a Stradivari? This all has to do with the myth about violin value, which was created by a couple dealers saying to teachers, you want to have your students buy this Stradivari or this Guarneri or this Amati because of a label. There are lots of wonderfully sounding Stradivaris, but there are also Stradivaris that don't sound as good acoustically.
But there was an assumption, be it an old instrument, that meant that the instrument's quality of tone and vibration and sound was therefore better than anything that would come after.
Right. And the irony is that people forget that Stradivari himself was a contemporary maker in his own time. Mm-hmm. He was not making instruments to look old. He was making contemporary instruments. So people tend to forget that there is this whole body of argument from the dealers who make a lot of money on high-priced violins, that violin value has to do with a label or provenance or the collector or the dealer, and nothing to do with acoustics. So what Carlene did with was turn to the player and say, trust yourself, trust your ears. What works for you? What feels right? You can judge for yourself. You don't need the dealer to tell you what's valuable. You can listen acoustically. You can play a new instrument and have an open mind about whether the instrument is old or new. How does it sound? And does it feel right for you?
And she would actually give people the opportunity to borrow the instrument, play it, get a feel for it, and see if it resonated with them.
She was totally open about that. She wasn't possessive. If anything, she was seeking players to test her instruments, to tell her so she could know more about what was and was not working.
Now, if you're just joining us, this is Yvonne Donitz. You're listening to Healthy Worth Healthy Living. And my guest today is Quincy Whitney, author of American Luthier, The Art and Science of the Violin. And she's specifically talking about the history and the unique gifts of Carlene Hutchins. How did you organize the Hutchins story? You were talking a little bit about that before. You were multitasking, right?
I organized it in three different ways. I guess I would summarize by saying different hats, different fiddles, and different ideas. And the different hats, I realized that as many women who are fitting a career or a passion in and around mothering, Carlene wore many hats. And when I broke down different parts of her life and thought about what hat she'd put on, that's basically what I came up with as an organizational theme for the beginning, for the first part of the book. So she's first a naturalist. She's an only child, in love with the outdoors, and really starting to whittle when she was age 8, becoming a master woodworker by the time she's in high school. She's a naturalist who goes to Cornell and studies biology, and is very, because she's an observer of nature, it's natural that she would become a teacher. So she becomes a science teacher at the Woodward School in Brooklyn, and she sort of cuts her teeth on creating a science lab out of nothing in a Victorian house in an experimental school. So she's very used to improvising. And then she gets a chance to go to teach at the Brearley School with a little bit of a pay increase, and she goes to this posh prep school on the east side of Manhattan, and she's teaching grade school science. And what's interesting about her as both an outsider and is that she ends up being led by her curiosity and her courage. So each time, every couple of years, some other question gets raised to her, and then she puts on another hat. She's a naturalist and she's a teacher, and then she's at the Brearley, and she understands that her colleagues all love chamber music, and they're playing chamber music recreationally in their apartments at night, and they invite her to come, and she brings her trumpet. She played trumpet throughout high school and was a first chair in both band and orchestra. And they basically turn to her after one night and say, this is way too loud. We need a viola. And as most quartets do, you always need a viola. And would you teach yourself viola? So she trades the trumpet for the viola. She goes and buys a $75 one from Wurlitzer's and starts playing, taking lessons. She's now a violist. Then she goes away for 2 years to teach at a public school, comes back to Brearley, and in the fall of 45, she is about ready to start school. It's the day before the students arrive, and she meets Helen Rice. And Helen Rice is a great lady of chamber music. She's been hired to start the music department, the string department particularly, at Brearley, and she's only got one string player. But she also has a very pregnant sow on the family farm in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and she has an agenda when she meets Carlene. She hasn't met her yet. She introduces herself and says, Carlene, I understand that you teach grade school science and you have a lot of animals in your lab. And Carlene says, yes, I do. I have chickens and rabbits and guinea pigs. And so Helen says, how would you like a piglet? And Carlene's excited. Well, that would be great to have a piglet, but we have to get approval from the principal. And Helen says, I think we can manage that. But the deal is, if you get this piglet in your classroom, you have to agree to bring your viola on Friday afternoons to play chamber music with my students, which Carlene did. And the two of them become great friends. And then one day she turns to Helen and she looks at the $75 viola and she feels like it's a cigar box and maybe she could make it sound better. And Helen says she's crazy. It takes many, many years to learn the craft. You're absolutely nuts. And if you do make a viola, Carlene, I'll eat my hat. And 2 years later, Carlene makes that viola. And sure enough, Helen bakes a cake in the shape of a hat and wears it. So then she's become a violist and she'd become a luthier. Now then, she takes her viola to her friends, the chamber music friends, and they test it out. And they say, well, you know, it's not half bad, Carlene. Maybe you should check take it out to a master luthier and find out what else you can do to make it better. So she takes it to Carl Berger near Carnegie Hall, German violin maker, and he says, would you like me to help you make it better? And she says, yes. So he takes his little tools and he takes it all apart in front of her. It's all pieces in front of her. And she's about ready to cry because she wasn't planning on ever making another one. And then he says, if you carve here and you carve there and you put it back together, it'll sound better. So now you've hooked the scientist in her, because she's after all a biologist, and she gets curious. She goes home and she makes those adjustments, and she comes back to Berger a month later and she puts the sandwich together, and sure enough, it sounds better. And now she's really hooked. About a month later, Helen Rice says to her, well, you really ought to go meet Frederick Saunders. He's a retired Harvard physicist out in South Hadley, and he is also a passionate chamber music player. So he plays viola and he plays violin, and he's doing these test chamber experiments of playing in a test chamber with and trying to figure out the dynamics of violin acoustics. So Helen and Carlene go to visit Saunders, and Saunders takes her viola. She's only still made one at this point. And he tests it, and he plays it, and he says, well, this is really interesting, and Miss Hutchins, I'd like to see what your next one's going to look like. Carlene wasn't planning on making another one. But at that point, Saunders hands her the reprints of his articles about violin acoustics, and she's a biologist, and she's reading these papers, and she's thinking, I don't really get this jargon because it's a physicist's jargon. But the one thing she did understand, she was very good at reducing things down to some commonsensical ways of looking at it. And she said, I do notice that you're only able to put a little weight on the bridge of the instrument. And Saunders said, yes, I don't want to destroy the instrument. And Carlene said, well, what would happen if you actually had expendable instruments that you could test and not worry about that? And he said, well, what luthier would be crazy enough to spend all that time making an instrument in the white and then having it destroyed? And she said, I will. So now she's suddenly gone from the violist to the luthier to the scientist. And she's now an apprentice to both Carl Berger to learn luthery, and she's also an apprentice to the scientist figuring out acoustics, and they do about 100 different experiments. That, the combination of working with violin acoustics with Saunders and two other colleagues, John Schelling and Bob Frixell, the four of them were buddies and just started talking violin acoustics, and eventually John Schelling makes a joke that we are the Catgut Acoustical Society, which is the catalyst, and now there is an organization in 1963 around her ping pong table, and she's getting together the people that care about violin acoustics. This also happens at about the same time that she serendipitously published her first article. The first article was called The Physics of Violin, and it was Violins, and it was published in the November issue of the 1962 Scientific American. In fact, the cover of my book is this image, the Walter Tandy Murch painting of a violin experiment that happened in her basement. But this is an image that everyone all over the world in luthery knows, because Carlene lucked into, this is the serendipity of her path. She did her first article. She had only done articles with Saunders up to this point. And in November 62, Scientific American suddenly had an opening for the cover, because one article that they were going to run wasn't vetted and didn't work. So she just happened to luck out, and they ran her article as a cover article. And as a result, to her amazement, luthiers and physicists were writing her letters from all over the world, because everyone was intrigued about this issue of violin acoustics and applying acoustics to making a better fiddle. So suddenly the Catgut Acoustical Society was growing to 800, you know, to 1,000 members, and it existed for 30 years, and she published an international newsletter devoted to violin acoustics for this group. So she becomes an editor because the American Physics Society asks her to edit the violin papers on violin acoustics, the benchmark papers. She does two sets of those volumes, so she's an editor. And lastly, she's a lecturer, because she cares about sharing what she knows, and she takes her instruments on the road, probably 200,000 miles in 30 years, and she would lecture to any place that invited her. And often it was the science department, not the music department. A lot of music conservatories were very confused about what to do with this new set of instruments. Juilliard invited her to speak three times, and three times she was uninvited before she got there. So it tells you something about that love-hate relationship the music conservatory had. But the physicists were very open to hearing about how physics is applied in music and in violin making.
If you're just joining us now, you're listening to Healthy Words, Healthy Living. This is Yvonne Dunnett, WSMN 1590, Nashville source for news and talk radio. And my guest today is author Quincy Whitney. on this wonderful book, The American Luthier, a story about Carlene Hutchins and the amazing work that she has done. And in Whitney's story here, she combines history, the essence of Carlene Hutchins, and what she invented. So what did Hutchins actually invent?
The violin octet, which is eight instruments across the range of a piano, as I said a little bit earlier. The second half of the book is related to the different fiddles. She made seven sets of octet violins. She also made conventional instruments, violas, cellos. So she's made almost 500 instruments. And I'd like to say here that I'm looking for anyone in the country or in the world that own a Hutchins instrument, because I would like to find out where they are and encourage people to come to book signings and bring an instrument.
So how would they let you know that? Is there a particular website that you'd like them to connect with you at?
Yes, www.quincywhitney.com. An email is quincy@quincywhitney.com. And as I say, I would love to know more about that. The second half of the book actually talks about her life through the six octets that she made, that are now, four of them are in museums, which is unfortunate when the instrument is treated only as an artifact, because they don't tend to be lent out to musicians, although this is not true for the University of Edinburgh. But the instruments are the Hutchins violin octets are in the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, Music Museet in Stockholm, Sweden. There was one in St. Petersburg, Russia for 5 years, and there is one at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. There's another one at the National Music Museum in Vermilion, South Dakota. And the two that are being played, I would love to put a plug in here for the Hutchins Consort, which was founded in 2000 by bassist Joe McNally. Ever since he heard the bass for the first time, he dreamed that he could put the consort together. He did that, and they are in San Diego, California, and they go up and down the California coast, playing everything from a wide repertoire, from medieval and Renaissance music to jazz and modern. They're a wonderful group, and there is a total new palette of sound that they are giving in bowed stringed instruments.
It's interesting. So each component revealed a different saga, success, and response. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yes. Edinburgh was the very first one. She'd been 20 years trying to get these instruments even paid attention to in New York. And unfortunately, she was in America, but she was in the metropolitan New York area, which is the very toughest with respect to professional musicians and anything new. And then she, through her contacts of creating an international organization, she got to know physicists and some musicians, most of them physicist musicians, scientists that were string players, which seems to be she was attracting those people. And the University of Edinburgh became the success story, which was the beginning. And it was ironically, she found open-minded musicians, particularly one musician, Roderick Skeeping, who had grown up with a father who was very instrumental in England in the early music movement. The irony about the early music musician is that you might think that they're stuck in the past, but actually they have to be very good improvisers, and they have to be open-minded, because none of them are trained on Baroque instruments, right? They get trained on traditional instruments, and then they have to make all those adjustments in tuning and in playing and in ergonomics. So ironically, the early music background that Roderick had made him the most open to the octet. He was excited about a family of instruments. It was not foreign to him, because that's what early music is based on, recorders and viols. So he understood everything about it and accepted it. And that was the first time in 25 years that Carlene had any kind of positive feedback. To this day, Edinburgh is the most exciting place for the instruments, because they're actually considered contemporary instruments and they're loaned out to musicians.
Really?
So I envision that sometime in the next year, I hope that I could go over there and the group could come and we could celebrate this set of instruments in the museum, because they have always been dedicated to the acoustical aspect and the musical aspect, and helping scientists and players understand more about what Carlene did and enjoy the instruments.
That would be a beautiful place for you to go back to and bring your book, have a book signing, and literally celebrate her life and the difference she made. That's something that you should start planning. I think that would be phenomenal.
Actually, I've already made an application to the Edinburgh Book Festival. I don't think that our timing is very good, but perhaps next year. But I am invited to come and speak at the American Musical Instrument Society meeting in Edinburgh next year, in 2017.
Fantastic. Congratulations on that. That's
Thank you. Wonderful. Now, in contrast, the one in Stockholm is the exact opposite. Because of the political climate of a particular museum, although it started out auspiciously, now the museum is closed and there are 13,000 musical instruments in a graveyard, you know, not literally buried under dirt, but in a warehouse 13 kilometers outside the city, not being accessed at all.
So, is there a way of getting those instruments and placing them into a U.S. museum?
I don't think so. I think politically you just have this museum that didn't make it and you have all these instruments. So I don't know what the solution is there. Wow. And then another octet is, which was a very exciting story, was the St. Petersburg one in Russia. And that was the one where professional musicians were playing them the most in some really amazing settings. But then finally it sort of dissolved after 5 years because the Russians wanted to continue to be paid by Carlene, and she had no more funds. She was paying $70,000 over 5 years to get the thing going in Russia. We got the first recording of the instruments, but then it sort of dissolved based on the inability of Carlene and her organization to keep paying them to play. So that's another instance of something that worked in for a while but couldn't be sustained.
Isn't that too bad? So are there, if you were to get hold of those instruments, either in Stockholm or in St. Petersburg, would there be a way of finding musicians where you could actually tour with the playing of the instruments in celebration of what she invented and created and help the word get out again about her contribution into the music world as well as science and art?
I think it would be amazing.
Wouldn't
I've actually
it?
Envisioned that it would be amazing to have an convention. We had one in 2005 devoted to the octet instruments, but it was basically including only the Hutchins consort because they were the ones domestically here. But I'm thinking how wonderful it would be to get the octets together from museums. But the other interesting aspect is she taught about 50 students how to make violins and how to make some octet instruments. And there are some makers here in America that are making octet instruments. And one of them is Alan Caruth in Newport. He's made a couple of tenors that I know of. But there are also second generation makers who studied with her. There's one in Belgium. He's made the first Belgian octet. And there's one in Genoa, Italy, and he's made the first Italian octet.
You need to gather them all together.
It would be amazing.
Wouldn't that?
It would be amazing to gather them all together.
You could do an amazing thing. You really could?
Yes. It would be quite amazing to get them all together.
Yes, it would be an amazing
thing. International legacy of Carlene Hutchins.
Exactly, and do a tour with it, and the music, and to see, and the discussion of how and the what, and all of the science behind the art and the music, and how it all came together, and how you assisted in bridging that all. Fascinating, fascinating. Now, you added another dimension into your wonderful book, and there are the intermezzos. And you were beginning to talk about that before. And if you've just joined us, my guest today is Quincy Whitney. You're listening to Healthy Words, Healthy Living. This is Yvonne Dunnetts. And Quincy wrote an excellent book about Carlene Hutchins and her creative work called American Luthier. And so talk about your intermezzos, and can you tell us about why you chose to use the musical motif in your book and how you went from one component to another?
The intermezzos not only set the historical context for different subjects like history of music and acoustics and luthery and applying science to music, but they also discovered as I was doing my research that they really were dispelling people's assumptions. One thing is that some luthiers get angry about the octet because they think that the quartet is a sacred cow. You can't touch the quartet. It's the best. It's already... Well, there's all these historical precedents for the fact that people were always seeking to fill the gaps in the quartet. There's a missing tenor voice. There are three different luthiers since the 1850s who have tried to build a family of violins. So it's not like she was trying to do something that was an anomaly. But people get attached to what they have, and they tend to think that the quartet always existed. Well, before the quartet, there were also families of instruments, all kinds, in the Baroque period, where there were huge orchestras, all different kinds of varied instruments. So I think we've reduced down our expectation in string music and think of it as a string quartet or an orchestra, when actually there's many other variables in between. But I think generally these intermezzos are meant to give a context, but also explain that other people may be assuming something to be true when history proves it differently.
And as a woman, What were the challenges that Carlene had in this field?
She was not only a luthier in the toughest metropolitan New York area, but she was a female in three male-dominated fields of luthery, acoustical physics, and classical music. And there were dealers telling teachers at one time, don't let your students buy a Hutchins violin because she puts electronic synthesizers in them, which was a total lie. Mm. But there are many dealers that couldn't understand how she could create a more dynamic and louder, more resonant instrument. So they just figured it had to be some gimmick. But she found it very difficult to be accepted by the community. And there was also a part of her that was a maverick. She was never... As an only child, she always did what she wanted to do and pursued what interested her. And she believed in sort of learning by doing. That's the way she taught students. So she developed a tough hide about that and decided that it wasn't something she could totally take on. At the same time, it's the reason that people don't know who she is outside the field of violin making.
You have a quote in here in your prelude about her that I find very interesting, and I'd love to share this with the listening audience. You say, Carlene Hutchins touched every corner of the violin world, the study of sound, music, and violin making, history and anatomy, science and violin acoustics, consorts, musicology, museum collections, virtuosos, and the violin market. Like the immutable parts of a fiddle working together to produce one marvelous sound, all these worlds connected to one another as the interlocking themes of the fugue played out in the life of Carlene Marley Hutchins.
Thank you. Neat.
I liked how you put that all together. So why did you write American Luthier?
I think it was basically when you start out... with a biography, it's very much like Carlene's life herself. You don't start out figuring out what the end result is. If I knew how long it was going to take me to do this biography, I'm not sure I would have jumped off the cliff. But I just kept getting more and more intrigued by the way her life intersected with all different disciplines. And the art, science, music was something that had always fascinated me. Since college, I was fascinated I was fascinated by Chaucer in freshman year because Chaucer was all about the umbrella of faith and that you could be sacred and secular in a day, and that he could write a body story but also have a lesson. And I really felt like there was the sacred secular there. And then the art, science, music, I've always just been interested about the parallels and about the bridges rather than the walls. And so I guess I was drawn, like Carlene was drawn to the fiddle, I was drawn to her story. And as a journalist, you come across a few stories in your lifetime, true stories. That's what we live on. And this story I couldn't make up. It kept getting more and more amazing with every interview that I did. And I thought, I guess that's why I was drawn to it.
And there was a component of it related to the issue of invisibility and gender. Talk to us about that.
There is a wonderful national monument in Ringe, New Hampshire, called at the Cathedral of the Pines. The one that everybody knows is called the Altar of the Nations. And it's in my first book about New Hampshire history. And that is a beautiful outdoor chapel and an altar that looks out on Mount Monadnock. Many people get married there. But in order to get married there, they have to go by the second story, which is always the one that no one knows. There are brides that tell me, I don't know what I walked by. This is a 55-foot bell tower devoted to women who gave their lives for their country. And there's beautiful bronze panels on each side of the column that were designed by Norman Rockwell. And no one knows what they're walking by. It's 10 times bigger than the altar. And so it's invisible in plain sight. And it seems to me a perfect metaphor for women's history. It's like that footprints in the sand at the beach where the waves just keep washing over. And I'll tell you one story about that. About a month ago, I went to New York City sort of looking for different venues for book signings. And I went to two violin dealers. And one violin dealer, Gregory Singer, knew Carlene. He was the one dealer that she trusted. If you needed to sell any of my instruments, she said, would you, you know, go to Gregory? So I had a wonderful visit with him. He played a little bit and said, you know, if you find a book venue, it really is, my shop's too small, you know, let me know. And he actually played for my book event in Brooklyn last weekend at Jalopy Theater and School of Music in Red Hook, Brooklyn. But the other dealer was a complete opposite. He looked at my book. He saw that epilogue where I talk about invisibility, and he nodded to me. He got pensive, and he said, "The luthiers don't talk about her." And I thought, that's why I wrote the book. That we have luthiers who celebrate her and actually acknowledge what she did, but we have other luthiers who would write her out of the narrative because of this envy or the female part or whatever. But if it was a man who had contributed this, there would be a different orientation. They would be coronating him and celebrating him for what he contributed. The fact that it was a woman is the reason that some people embrace what she did and others do not.
Mm. You wrote this kind of a poem called Soundpost. May I read it?
Yes, I should preface it by saying that...
Or would you like to read it?
I'll read it.
I think it really... preface it and
I close my story about Carlene with a poem that was inspired by the fact that if you were to liken all of the pieces of the violin world to the violin itself, there's 81 pieces in a violin. I was trying to think of the piece of the violin that most reflected Carlene, and I feel like it was the soundpost. So here's the poem I wrote about the soundpost. Just a small, sturdy, dense column of wood that does little more than hold up the world. Unlikely conduit wedged to edges of carved spruce and maple, this upright post holds the space between as if sacred. Wedged, not glued in place, a channel for sound between opposites, top and back held at bay, connecting nothingness to form a whole, allowing air currents to swirl inside, maintaining the ribs of separation. A conduit, a short circuit between rocking bridge and box, it amplifies sound of bow on string, thus keeping the fiddle from caving in on itself, air snuffed out from the sheer force of the bow on the strings. A minute, invisible inch of wood, the part of the fiddle hidden from view, except from those who know to look for it, maker, player, dealer, or collector, seeking to adjust the sound with the key, a vertical post, tall talisman held still by friction. Without it, the violin mimics a guitar. The space between matters most, for the conduit across time and space, between science and art, linking the two across the great divide, building a bridge where there had been a wall. Wedged between two worlds, yet glued to neither, still able to move, to change position, jockey for space, or make an adjustment. One tiny move can make the most difference. The space between a hush or rush of wind, a single post poised in the space between, finding the perfect resting place somewhere inside the crevice that cradles the sound.
Beautiful. So beautiful. So if you want to learn about an amazing woman, an amazing scientist, artist, and musician, that with her motivation, her curiosity, her stick-to-itiveness, her want to really create something that was profoundly resonant, that would vibrate and share music in a way that had not been known before. And she really captured some of the research, in a sense, that was done years ago by some people, right?
Mm-hmm. She did.
And then she brought it forth with a tremendous stick-to-itiveness, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, she was always willing to give credit to the other person before her. Yeah. And take that research and go further.
So why would you want the audience to consider reading and getting this book, American Luthier by Quincy Whitney?
I think Carlene gives us an example of how to follow your passion. I would say that was something that her son said at her funeral. He was he's a lawyer, and he said, there are lawyers before me and there will be lawyers after me. But my mother created a life and a career out of her passion, out of nothing. And who among us can say we did that? And I think it's not only her ability to create a life around what she loved, but it's the lessons we learn about balance and about what she learned herself. And it's about sticking to an idea and following following the ripples where they go. She did not set out to do what she was going to do. She just took one question at a time, and then was sort of drawn along in that journey. And then it became her life. So there's ways to look at that both ways, positive and negative, about, you know, how do you balance home with your passion and how do you balance parenting? That's another way that gender plays a role here, is that she's judged differently about how she was able to balance the domestic scene with her passion, because the fiddles took over the house. But if she were a man, we don't tend to judge whether Chekhov or Einstein was a good father. We look at what their work was. So there's a way to look at both sides of the issue. And Carlene, to me, is a very fascinating story in how to follow your passion and the lessons you learn along the way about that.
And she met some very dynamic, strong women.
She did, in
that
fact.
That really supported her work.
Yes, yes.
And encouraged her.
This was in the 50s and 60s when it was, you know, she was at Cornell, and even though they accepted women, she didn't have any social life at all because they were kept separate and no one dated a co-ed. So she had a generation of very close friends, who many of whom were professional women, but were told by society that they had to choose. They became professional women, and that meant they didn't become parents. She was one of the few among six or seven friends that actually had children also and was trying to balance all that. Trying to figure it out.
And she had a very supportive husband.
Extremely supportive husband. He really became the Mr. Mom. He was Mort was a color chemist, and did so much domestically to keep track of the household, and raise the children. Very, very much. She could not have done it without Mort, and she knew that.
Yes. He realized that she had a gift. And he really supported her in every way possible.
And the remarkable thing about Mort was that he was tone deaf. So he didn't have this bridge to music like she did.
No.
So there was this separation that sort of allowed him to support her, but didn't mean there was a connection with them about music.
Hmm. But he had a wonderful understanding of her abilities. Of her passion and abilities. Now, when did Carlene die?
She died in 2009.
And did she see the ending of this book? Did she see the finished book?
No, the challenge for me, ever since I met her, was I was always wrestling with whether I was writing this book while she was still living. And she was always wonderfully perfect about not hovering or telling me what to write. She didn't have any ownership of anything, except to give me access to everything, all of her documentation and everything in the house. And but then when she passed, I felt like there was a freedom there. I don't think that the book would have been that substantially different, but I tell a funny story about the fact that about a year before she died, she sort of cornered me one day when I visited her, and she said, she was quite upset, and she said, "How come I haven't seen the book yet?" And I said, "Because you left an incredible paper trail, and I have to read the paper trail. I can't make it up. Biographers don't make it up. And so I have to read your, you know, archives, your house full of archives." And then she really understood it, because she was a child of the Depression. She kept everything. So the house at 112 Essex in Montclair, New Jersey, was both the dream of a biographer and the nightmare, because I didn't have to go anywhere else to find it. But there was so much there. It was overwhelming.
Is the house now a museum to her?
No.
You would think with all
it
that
was
stuff.
Like a museum when you visited it, because she never threw anything away. And she would have duplicates of many, many things. So you had to weed through all of this. And that's what took so long, the research, was when I would go visit her, I had to start sorting and figure out. And then she went through her files and she would tell me about who these people were and why they're important. So much information.
And you're now, the book has just been released, and you have a number of upcoming book signings and events occurring. Please let our audience know how they can meet you, learn about your wonderful book, and some of the events that you have.
Thank you. I've just spent 3 weeks on the road because of some conferences in the Carolinas. Got back from Brooklyn last week. And I will be at the Barnes & Noble in Nashua this coming Thursday, the 28th at 7 p.m. This Saturday, the 30th, I will be at the Newburyport Literary Festival at the Newburyport Library at 3:30 in the afternoon. On May 4th, I will be at River Run Books in Portsmouth. On May 5th, I'll be at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord. On May 6th, I'll be at the National Country Club to an open to the public event, which will also include some music. On Saturday, May 7th, I'll be at Toadstool Books in Peterborough. On Monday, May 9th, I'll be at Peddler's Daughter, Irish Pub, 7 o'clock. And on the 12th, I will be at Water Street Books in Exeter. And on Friday, May 13th, I will be at Porter Square Books. Yes. I'm very, very excited also to say that on June 2, I will be reading an excerpt and giving a talk about my book to the Women's History Discussion Group at the Library of Congress.
Wonderful. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's very exciting. So the May 6th at the Country Club, anyone can come to that because there you're going to have music, you said.
Yes.
Tell us about that. Are you bringing musicians that actually are playing her instruments?
Yes. Ellen Carlson is a fiddler, a bluegrass fiddler, and she and her duo are going to be there, and she's going to be playing a Hutchins mezzo that she purchased. She also knew Carlene and at the time was very fascinated with her mezzo, so she's going to have a Hutchins mezzo that she'll be playing.
Fantastic. So people can actually hear the instrument.
Yes.
And are there any upcoming concerts where people would hear all eight of the instruments?
I wish, but that group is in California, and that's not happened yet. The book is just 3 weeks out, and we're working on ways to get the two coasts together. This group came in 2011 and did some concerts, and we'd like to bring it back. I'd also like to go to the West Coast and follow them around, because now the story can meet the group. Right. And the group's been around for 15 years waiting for the story to be told.
Fantastic. So if people wanted to learn more about the book, American Luthier by Quincy Whitney, they can go online. And where would they go online?
QuincyWhitney.com. And there's a new website and also a list of events. And you're welcome to give any feedback. But yes,
QuincyWhitney.com.
Yes.
Quincy, again, to the audience, Quincy is the author of American Luthier, the story about Carlene Hutchins. It bridges the art, the science, and music into one remarkable book about a remarkable woman who really, really strived to do some amazing, amazing things. How are her children taking to all of this?
The children, throughout the time that I was interviewing her, They're let's just say, reticent.
Okay. Well,
but not the grandchildren. The grandchildren are quite proud of her.
Excellent. Well, you've been listening to Healthy Words, Healthy Living. This is Yvonne Dunitz. May the longtime sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. Thank you so much, Quincy Whitney, for joining us. Thank you, audience, for being with us. Have a fantastic day. Until next week. Bye now.